Taking Control of Adverse Events, a conversation with Patty Austin. This webinar included a visual PowerPoint presentation. To view a video recording, visit the link in the description of this podcast.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our series of webinars focused on bringing you information about COVID-19-related topics. The information in these weekly webinars is geared toward long-term care and skilled nursing facilities, but we encourage everyone who's interested to attend. My name is Kathy Caudill. I'm a communications specialist with Quality Insights. Today's webinar is Taking Control of Adverse Events. And now I'd like to introduce our guest today, Patty Austin. Patty is a quality improvement specialist at Quality Insights. She has been working in the skilled nursing arena for the past 29 years, starting her career as a nursing assistant and leaving the front lines as director of nursing. Patty has been with Quality Insights since 2016, and she considers it a privilege to be able to interact with so many different nursing facilities to help create lasting change within their communities. Patty, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And welcome, everybody. Another Wednesday under our belts, right, as we're watching spring roll in. So today we're going to talk about adverse events and how we can take control of them. Our goal today is going to be to kind of make the connection between adverse events and hospital events and to gain a better understanding of what the term adverse events actually means. And then finally, we're going to take a look at a tool called the Adverse Event Tool and showcase how it uses the QAPI process to help you to analyze adverse events as they occur so that you can put plans in place to prevent possible future events from occurring. So let's get started and take a look. The term adverse event is one that we're all familiar with, and sometimes we kind of toss it around without giving a lot of thought to what we're actually saying when we use those words. So as we get started today, let's look at some of the key terms and the context in which they're used by people like the Office of the Inspector General and CMS. You might see the terms adverse event and patient safety event used interchangeably. As you begin a facility initiative that's focused on patient safety, it can be pretty important to be very clear about your basic terminology. And that starts with making sure that you and your staff share an understanding of what the word adverse means. Webster's Dictionary, it's always my go-to, they make it pretty easy. By definition, adverse means opposed to one's interests or causing harm. To make it even easier to relate to members of your staff, to your residents, and to your families, it might be helpful to also recognize the synonyms that are listed by Webster's. Those synonyms include words like hazardous, risky, harmful, and even dangerous. So when we break it down, what we're really trying to prevent are dangerous patient events. And that's a pretty powerful phrase. It can sometimes be more easily understood in that terminology when you're in kind of promoting the importance of a patient safety program to your facility and creating that culture that strives to prevent those events from occurring. The phrase adverse event was most likely coined and became part of our vernacular when the OIG began to highlight the impact that those adverse or dangerous patient events had on Medicare beneficiaries as a result of their interaction with the healthcare community. So in September of 2023, the OIG released a report that define the key terms in this way. An adverse event is one in which care results in an undesirable clinical outcome that's not an outcome of their underlying disease. That event either prolonged the patient's stay, caused permanent patient harm, required life-saving interventions, or contributed to the death of the patient. They went on then to further clarify and define patient harm as harm to a patient or resident in our case as a result of medical care or harm that occurred in the healthcare setting. It's important to note that that definition included the failure to provide needed care. Equally as important is the clarification that harm doesn't really need to be permanent and that temporary harm is indeed included. The OIG considers all-cause harm, regardless of preventability or cause, when it classifies something as an adverse event. That OIG update goes on to state that each year, millions of Medicare beneficiaries experience adverse events as a result of medical care in the healthcare setting. Those events can be the result of errors, substandard care, known side effects, or unexpected complications that may or may not have been preventable. Despite nationwide efforts to improve patient safety, reducing patient harm remains a challenge for the Department of Health and Human Services and for our nation's healthcare providers. In its most recent report, the OIG updated the national incident rates of patient harm. Its findings were that a full quarter of Medicare patients experienced adverse events, and that 43% of those actually could have potentially been prevented. Earlier reviews also raised concerns about the prevalence of harm in post-acute care facilities. In those settings, harm rates ranged between 13 and 43%. Additionally, they found that harm events in SNFs were often preventable and, of course, were very costly to the Medicare program. So in light of those findings, the Department of Health and Human Services took additional steps to further promote and incentivize patient safety. The OIG most recently recommended that HHS reassess and update their efforts related to the National Strategy for Quality Improvement in Healthcare. They recommended that they optimize national patient harm surveillance tools and expand their efforts to disseminate information about best practices and national clinical guidelines. The OIG also recommended to HHS that they take additional steps to align those payment processes more effectively with quality and to provide guidance to surveyors that assess our compliance when tracking harm events. It's a lot of words. Until now, we have been speaking pretty broadly about all healthcare settings that serve Medicare beneficiaries. But in 2014, the OIG did release a report on adverse events, specifically in SNFs. Shockingly, it reported that one out of every three of SNF beneficiaries were impacted by an adverse event within the first 35 days of their skilled stay. And that is a whopping number when you consider that when you look at your census, and think that one of three of the residents that you're looking at, those people that you know and have entrusted their care to you, one in three of them have or will experience an adverse event within those first 35 days. Furthermore, 60% of those were deemed to be preventable. And those are numbers that really require attention, I think. I'm sure you agree. So enter the CMS initiative that focuses on determining if nursing homes can reduce rehospitalizations. The goal of that CMS initiative was to determine why nursing home residents were rehospitalized, which residents were being rehospitalized, and what the outcomes were for those residents. During the study, residents who were treated on site in the nursing home were directly compared to those residents who were treated in the hospital for one of six conditions. The findings were surprising to a lot of us and probably many of you, and they showed that residents who were initially treated in the hospital were about twice as likely to experience a rehospitalization. Even more impactful is more than twice as likely to die as compared to those residents who were initially treated in the nursing home. So 17% of residents who were transferred to the hospital for their initial treatment of a changing condition died versus 7 0.8% of residents who were initially treated at the facility. This study may actually cause maybe a paradigm shift in the way that we think about rehospitalizations. Kind of moves the conversation away from being one that is primarily financially based to one that considers the impact that avoidable hospitalizations have not only on quality of life, but on quantity of life. Those residents that are initially sent to the hospital may actually have a lower life expectancy than those that are appropriately treated in place. That study is ongoing and one that I'm sure is going to remain on the forefront of our improvement efforts as we move into the next few years. If you're curious, as I was, as to what those six diagnoses in the OIG report identified as the top reasons for readmissions, they are listed on the screen for you now. The first was sepsis, then COPD and asthma, pneumonia, CHF, UTIs, and dehydration. So, as you begin any hospitalization reduction project, those would be really good starting points for you. In the report on adverse events, the OIG recommended that CMS collaborate with AHRQ to develop and promote a listing of potential events that occur in nursing homes specifically to raise awareness of adverse events that harm our residents. Using that OIG study, CMS and AHRQ worked together to create a list of the most commonly potentially preventable adverse events. They then divided that list into three categories. The first category is potentially preventable events related to resident care. And I'm not going to read the slide, but you can see here that the idea of failure to provide needed care that we talked about a couple of slides back is kind of weaving its way through most of these preventable events. Of the eight events listed, we can see that the word inadequate appears in five of those events. And we could really easily add that concept to the three that don't use the word inadequate. Those are falls, pressure ulcers, and elopement. So really, these events are all about something that, had we done what we should have done, we may have been able to prevent. These are most likely the events that pop immediately to mind when we think about adverse events. They're falls, electrolyte imbalances, thromboembolic events, respiratory distress, exacerbation of pre-existing conditions, feeding tube complications, in-house acquired or worsening pressure ulcers, and elopement. So the next category we have is preventable events related to medications. And this goes past medication errors, and it incorporates the impact that the medication that we're giving is having on our residents and the monitoring of the residents who are receiving those specific medications. You're going to see dehydration pop up here. And we remember seeing that on our list of six diagnoses that CMS tracked in their study. So, during your efforts to reduce adverse events and hospitalizations, this would be a super list to kind of share with your pharmacist and engage in a discussion of how they're monitoring for these specific areas of risk and how they're interacting with the physicians and your facility leavers related to those risks. The events listed here include changes in mental status, hypoglycemia, ketoacidosis, bleeding related to anticoagulation, thromboembolism, prolonged constipation, specifically related to opiate use, electrolyte imbalances, drug toxicity, and altered cardiac output. And the last of our three categories is preventable events related to infections. So we've been talking for, maybe 11, 12 minutes now. You didn't think we would make it 13 minutes without talking about infection. Those days are long gone. So again, of note, two of our six tracked diagnoses from the original study show up here: pneumonia and UTIs. And these are also the events that can lead to sepsis, yet another tracked diagnosis. These events include respiratory infections, specifically flu and pneumonia, skin and wound infections, UTIs, and infectious diarrhea, both C. diff and norovirus. So now that we've taken, you know, a little bit of a deep dive into dangerous resident events, let's talk about how we can use this knowledge to take control of what we can control and manage the events. We've heard it one time, we've heard it 1,000 times. Knowledge is power. So if we want to create a powerful patient safety program, then we have to share our knowledge. Sharing what we know and harnessing the power of each individual under our roof can help us to create a culture of patient safety that's going to serve our residents, our staff, and our facility. So let's take a look at how we might begin to do that. And we're already prepared to get off to a running start when it comes to this initiative. The very first thing to do is to make sure that your facility, your staff, your residents, your families know that this thing is a thing. Shamelessly promote your efforts. And then walk the walk. Nothing is going to derail your efforts more than simply paying lip service to the idea and not following through with your commitment. But that doesn't mean to like sharpen your pencil up for disciplinary actions. What it might mean is sharpening your pencil up for true root cause analyses. It might mean devoting time to exploring areas that might have been on the back burner for a little while. It might mean creating uncomfortable situations while systems are changed. All change is uncomfortable. It might mean actively listening to the voices who can really help you solve those problems, residents, frontline staff, families. Might mean a couple of pizzas when a floor goes fall free for a couple of weeks. What it means for sure is that once you engage in a culture of safety, you can't do it today until noon and then pick it up again next Thursday. It means that every day, safety is at the forefront of everything you do. And the expectation is that everyone, not just those participating on your performance team, are engaged in that effort. As you're designing the team, consider adding non-employee members. We say this very often. For example, that pharmacist we talked about could really help with the medication-related adverse events. Families and residents might have great insight into resident care-related dangerous adverse events. And just a quick plug here for resident and family council. This is really a great place to report what you're working on, what you're trying, and what the results have been. Opening the floor for discussion could lead to some unexpected ideas to solve problems that you might not have previously considered. Part of creating a culture of patient safety is to make the QAPI process the rule and not the exception. By making it the expected standard, you will soon find that the processes happen without a ton of effort. When something unexpected occurs, people just naturally begin to ask why, rather than throwing that band-aid on the problem, like we sometimes tend to do. Small tests of change become the routine when processes need to be altered, rather than putting a flawed process into place facility-wide, only then to have to go back and change it a short time later. Soon, the expectation becomes the norm. The last bullet point might be the most important thing that we say here today. When something could have gone wrong but didn't, it's kind of our human nature to kind of look the other way and maybe say a quick thank you under our breath. Whether it's that frayed Hoyer sling that made its way to the linen cart, but the CNA pulled it prior to use, or a mispackaged medication that had a dangerous dose for a resident in it, or even something as simple as a walker left just out of an ambulatory resident's reach. Near-miss events happen. They happen every single day. Reporting those events needs to become a celebrated occurrence in your facility. I know that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but they can be your one and only chance to prevent a truly negative event from occurring before anybody even realized that the risk was present. I'll share a story from my early days as a DON that highlights the mindset change that I needed to have personally related to near-miss events. Every year at that facility, I would have a group of corporate nurses come in and complete a mock survey. Often I found that mock survey more anxiety-ridden than my regular Department of Health survey. The goal of that corporate team was to find the G-level deficiency. And by goodness, they would review and dig and dig and review until inevitably they uncovered that actual harm event. And initially, as a young DON, I took that very personally, as if it was the goal of that corporate team to make me personally look bad and to discredit the work of my team, who I know was working super hard to provide good care for our residents. So I slowly came to realize that finding the G was actually a gift. First, it allowed me the opportunity to investigate prior to my survey. It allowed me to acknowledge that it had happened. We had identified it and put plans in place to correct. Second, it afforded me the chance to ensure that processes surrounding that event were safeguarded to prevent future like events from occurring. Without that team discovering the G, serious resident outcomes could have resulted. So I learned to love discovering areas that are ripe for review and improvement. In a very real way, it's led me to the path of wanting to be a quality improvement specialist. I share that story to say this. Any day you can identify a near miss, investigate it, and put plans in place to correct the opportunity from happening in the future is a good day. Creating the culture of safety that you're seeking requires that your staff feels free and welcomed, and it's expected of them to self-report near misses that they identify. And that when they do identify those near misses, they're not punished for that, but celebrated for their proactive stance on patient safety. So let's take a look at a tool that can help you look at adverse events from a perspective of reducing hospital events. This tool, the Adverse Event QAPI Review, is designed to use the QAPI process in real time to ensure that those hospital events that you have weren't preventable. And if they were preventable, it then will guide you in determining why they occurred and what you can do to prevent like events moving forward. The intent is that this form would be completed with each hospital transfer and reviewed by your performance improvement team on a weekly basis. Let's look at the form section by section and what completing the form might look like for a fall adverse event. The top of the form is an area that contains very basic information. This is where you'll record the date of the event and the type of the event, along with the most recent facility admission date. Two things to note here. The first is that we as an industry know that hospital events that occur within 30 days of admission are more critical to us. And the second, as we learned today, the first 35 days are when our residents are most at risk. That means that any event that falls within 35 days of admission needs to be considered a little bit differently than those that fall outside of that window because they have happened in what we know is a time of risk. The final box you'll see there at the top is the event determination. You would complete that event determination, whether or not it was an avoidable event, after the review of the completed form. So you can see on our example that this event is a rehospitalization within 30 days of admission related to a fall. The next section is really the meat of the form, and it contains information that is directly tied to the QAPI process. First, you describe the event, and I can't recommend strongly enough that you use that SBAR format to describe your event. Doing that is going to help to ensure that all the vital information is included in that description, and it's also going to support your use of that technique within the facility. Next, we want to know what interventions were in place at the time of the event. That follows the premise of we don't know where we need to go until we know where we're coming from. The third piece is the root cause analysis. As always, that should be done with more than one person who has knowledge of the event. And the final piece is the new intervention. or what are you going to do your plan, do, study, act cycle on? These interventions may be directed at the specific resident involved in the event, or more broadly to a system surrounding the event. Sometimes it'll be both. To simplify the information in our example, we can see that this resident fell while walking to the bathroom about 2 hours after returning from therapy. She was sent to the hospital for an evaluation of the right hip. She, prior to the event, was ordered ambulation with a wheeled walker independently in her room, but was transitioning to a quad cane during her therapy sessions. The quad cane was inadvertently left in her room, and she had not been provided clear education related to continuing to use the walker until her orders had been officially changed. The PDSA cycle will include an equipment log in the therapy department to ensure that equipment is not accidentally accessible to residents. And therapy is going to complete a warm handoff upon return to the floor, and that's going to include reviewing the equipment present and any changes in that resident's functional status. The last section on our tool is the section in which you're going to document the dates in which the PDSA cycle is reviewed, any revisions that are indicated, the date of resolution, and a summary of the event after it's been resolved. In our case, we monitored this system change weekly for a month and then monthly for an entire 5 months. This is a fairly long review time. However, this facility felt it was needed because the potential for significant negative outcomes was present if the system failed, and because it was a change to a system that spanned more than one department, and that left multiple areas for the system or the intervention to fail. A revision is also documented. This need arose after an identified near miss in which a resident was observed walking without her walker and stated that was fine because that's what she was doing in therapy. The revision does include therapy to nursing handoff occurring in the resident room in the presence of the resident to ensure that everyone was on the same page with current safety interventions for that resident. This again is part of a typical PDSA cycle, monitor and review, revise when needed. The date resolved and the summary on our example are addressing the system change, but don't forget to link it back to the event that the resident experienced. And then this form would most likely become part of your incident report for documentation for the event. So, a quick review of using a pretty simple tool to analyze adverse events. This tool can be found on our website. If you would like to discuss implementing its use in greater detail, just reach out to your project coordinator and we would be more than happy to help dig into that, what that might look like for you. So at this point, I'm going to turn things back over to Kathy and see if we have any questions.
All right. Thank you, Patty. So far, I don't see any questions. So Patty, do you have any closing items that you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Only that we are pretty excited about the use of the adverse event review process. We think that it can be very beneficial in addressing a number of issues within the facility, and we are looking forward to talking with you individually more about that.
Patty, thank you for joining us again and for this presentation. And I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. Hope to see you again here soon.
If you would like to contact Patty Austin, you can reach her at paustin@qualityinsights.org. You can check out our other interviews at qualityinsights.org/QIN/multimedia.